This is the PubRight Podcast, a service of the Arbortex community.
With me today, I have Todd Hicks from Wolters Kluwer. Todd is well known in the Arbortex circles for doing all kinds of new, innovative, and amazing things with the editor and with his environment. Todd, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about when you got started and what prompted the change back then.
Well, I was the main Microsoft Word guy at what was then CCH Incorporated, which later got bought by Wolters Kluwer. And my boss sent me to this not very interesting sounding conference called the Arbortex User Group International. It was in Chicago that year, and so they didn't have to fly me anywhere. And I went there, and there was this company called Arbortex, and they had all these products that they were trying to sell us, but we'd already bought them. Everybody at the conference had already bought the Arbortex products, so there was really no reason to be that way. I was really interested. I'd been interested and been working with SGML for quite a while, and but it was kind of hard to find one's way through all that would appear to be advertising to us. And but to their credit, Arbortex asked people, what'd you think of the conference? And everybody said, we didn't need any more advertising. We just needed, you know, to share ideas. And from then on, Arbortex, the conferences got a lot more valuable to us and to me. So the next year, we changed from basically a type code-based publishing system to an SGML-based publishing system, and the editor of choice was Arbortex Editor. And a little while later, I was tapped to be the main Arbortex Editor guy, and they had just come out with the Windows version. I got used to it on Unix, and we developed a bunch of tools, and it was off to the races.
Wow, what year was that?
Well, the conference that I went to was in 97. I remember I was in Europe in 97. I had to fly back early from my trip to go to the silly conference in Chicago. And then it was actually 99 by the time we actually were seriously implementing it. So this my second conference was the one in Tucson, which was just absolutely great. I think that's still my favorite conference, possibly because of where it was, and possibly because of how much I learned and how excited I was, and the fact that I was kind of at the beginning of this this thing. Remember, usually when you get hired on to code to somebody else's framework. Well, there wasn't a framework. I was the guy. I was building the framework by myself. The whole Arbortex underpinnings for CCH, and I was just being flooded with ideas, and it was incredibly exciting. And so by 2000, we had a fairly good system, and I had somebody working for me, and we were cranking out tools.
Wow. So what was the first tool you built? Do you even remember?
There was a whole bunch of them. I remember a set of tools. You know what? I think the first one I may have built, because it was so easy to do, and I remember it so fondly, was a footnote renumberer. We do, because of the nature of our content, can't have automatic generated footnotes. It just can't be. People keep telling me that we should do it that way. We just can't. It just can't be. So it's footnote num equals, and if you insert footnote 250, num equals 250 in the middle of a chapter, and you got, you know, then you have two 250s, and you got to renumber them. My boss said, "Don't give it to them. They, you know, they don't need a footnote. Let them go through and do it by hand. Come on, you know, well, how hard is it? Just go through, modify attributes." I said, "Boss, I really don't feel good about that." He said, "You know, sorry, buddy, you got to do something else." So I stayed late and did it myself, and I gave it to him.
Wow.
And he found out later that I'd done it, and I didn't even get in trouble because they loved it so much. So that was fun. That was fun. Another tool that I did in the beginning was an ordered list insertion tool. Basically, these were tools that the whole idea is if there's business logic, and that's separate from DTD logic or DTD or schema kinds of things. For example, a list that really doesn't make sense to keep in the DTD, then, you know, go to the Arbortex customization team and tell them what it is, and they will figure out a way to put it into a list box or whatever. So that's what I did with an ordered list inserter. unordered list inserter. God, it's a bunch of stuff. My favorite, the one that gets used the most, is our link inserter, our XREF inserter. Link tag is called XREF. And we have a bunch of rules around that, and so I'm always happy to walk down the aisles at the home office and see people using that XREF tool.
Very cool.
Fun stuff.
My God. See, I knew you would have all kinds of interesting things in there. I just didn't know how many there were.
Oh, there's just so much stuff. We just have so much stuff. And the reason, the beauty of it, is that we are in the class of Arbortext customers who actually use the product to create our product. Our product right. is publishing. It's not airplanes. It's not bulldozers, right? It's actually the product itself. And so the sardines that we put in cans are words. And then we have to have a whole bunch of cans for them and ways to put them in the can and all that kind of stuff. So I don't catch the sardines. I just make the nets and make the cans and give them some way to put it to the customer.
Oh, very cool.
Give it to the customer.
So I know that there are several things that you've done in the last couple of years. One is the tool you showed, I guess, a year ago at Arbortext conference, that even Arbortext said, hey, can we have that?
They were really interested, and a lot of people in the audience were interested, and I was, of course, terribly flattered, but the truth is, I nudge them about this all the time, and of course, Charles comes back and says, yes, but it's a one-line piece of code. Wrong, kind of. It's find and replace attribute values. Right. In the editor, right. you can change some text, and you can, let's see, what is it? It's find rules, and then find tag attribute, which, you know, you can use those regular expressions for and all that kind of stuff, but you can't replace using that dialogue. You can do it in find replace if you want to use regular expressions to, you know, or the match markup thing. It's really, our users wouldn't use it. They looked at it and said, no, we can't. No, that won't work, you know. And so it was kind of on the plate for, about 10 years. It was one of the first ideas that we came up with when we first went to HTML. It was some way to globally or selectively go through an HTML or XML file and on element X change attribute Y from A to B, right? And given some rules. And so I'd been thinking about it for a long time. And finally, you know, the business came to us and said, we actually have a real, you know, honest-to-God business reason for doing this, for having the technology department create this thing. And I did. I woodshedded it for months. It took me about 2 months, 3 months probably, a month of design, 2 months of coding. It's a complex. Wow. It's a bear. And
certainly more than one line of code that Charles was talking about.
Oh, well, Charles could probably do it in one line of code, but I didn't, so. So I made a pretty complex dialog box that that has 1, 2, 3, 4 frames and a couple of this is what you're doing boxes. There's a search type frame, which is just find and replace. You can also find empty, meaning there's no value for it, and fill it with something. You can find anything, which means find any value at all, and replace it with what I say. You can do a find and delete, which is, you know, find the specified attribute value and delete it. And there's find any and delete. And if you click buttons, if you click find any and delete, fill something in, and then click replace all, a dialog box comes up and says, are you sure you want to do this? Are you positive? If you do, you know, and you wreck this file, you will be punished severely. And the users thought that was funny. And several people, when they were user acceptance testing, wrote back to say that they particularly liked that dialog box. Mainly, I think, because I didn't put the 500-volt charge between the chair. I didn't put that in phase one. But I did put in a rather humorous dialog box, which they wanted. They wanted to be alerted of those kinds of things. And I would say, if you want language in a dialog box. Yeah, I was an English major. I'll write it for you, but I'm going to write something kind of goofy, you know, and I'd rather you wrote something. So, and then there's search criteria, which are basically element and attribute. It's a dynamic dialog so that you see in the element list only those elements in this DTD that are present in the file. I'm looking at a small file, so there's only 5. And then as you click on each element in that list, the a list box to the right of it that says attribute. Yes shows you all of the attributes, the possible attributes of that element that can be changed according to our business rules and according to DTP. This is almost completely devoid of business rules, however. This is something that I've used on many DTDs, and it behaves exactly the same. Find me the elements in this file, display them, figure out each attribute, put it in an array. When you click on, para, you're going to get attribute, and the list will be aligned, indent style, output to, search segments, share pubs, blah. And then there's, if it's a name group, that's in a list box below. If there's no name group, then the list box becomes just a text box. It's all dynamic, right? So you can go and say para, change para align equals left to para align equals center, and replace all. And if it finds it, it'll change it. You can also, another business rule that they wanted was only to do this within the selection, or if you select something before you fire up the dialog box. Also within a specified element, so you can specify the parent element. You can also specify when other attribute equals such and such. So it's a fairly, and then you can do it one by one, and you can do replace all. It also has its own internal undo buffer, besides which you can just cancel out of it. If you do it and change, you still got undo in ArborText. So yeah, it's probably, it is the most complicated dialogue, interface kind of a dealy bob I ever did, and I'm quite proud of it. It's called Gaffer, GAFR, Global Attribute Finder Place. I tried to think of names for it. I was going to call it Global Finder Place Attribute, but you couldn't really pronounce that, Gaffra, and then it was going to be Global Attribute, or it was going to be Batch Attribute Replace Find. But I decided not to call it that.
Right.
So I decided to call it Gaffer, Global Attribute Finder Place.
Excellent. And so did they tell you what the business case happened to be that let it trigger after 10 years of thinking?
Yeah. Well, there were quite a few of them, but it was, I really don't exactly remember. I try to be kind of agnostic as to all those business cases they come up with. It was something where, I think it was a yearly thing where they had to go through and change all the blah attributes on all the woof elements, and they had to do it every year, and it took them, and they even came up with metrics, said it took us about this long last year to do it, and then with Gaffer this year, it took this much less time, and they saved a bunch of time.
Wow, yeah. That's good.
Yeah. So there's a business reason for it.
Yeah, well, I know we like to not think about those things when we're all wrapped up in the technology, but, it's always nice to add that on, too, to see what the whole picture looks like.
Yeah, well, fortunately or unfortunately for the world, gone are the days when I could just say, God, I think I need to have some fun. Let's see, I always wanted to code this thing. I think I can have some fun, boss. It's like, okay, go ahead. Nowadays we have to justify what we're doing, which generally I can find a good reason.
Yeah,
I get to have a lot of fun. But
oh, that's fair. Well,
business,
sure.
It's fun that the business asks for. Sometimes I make them think it was their idea. Oh, no, I didn't say that. No, it's always their idea.
Right. So, and this year you showed something brand new.
Yeah, this was another idea I've been thinking about for many years. I call it the XML farm, basically. Almost everybody is. I think it's one of the first things that you get into when you start presenting customizations to the users. What they want is to turn a text box into a list box. And you say, well, wait, ArborText does that by itself. Well, ArborText does that by itself if you're dealing with a name group. If you've got a specified list of things you can put in your attribute value, then the attributes box does come up with that list. But if you have business rules, or if you have a different, it's the same attribute and same element, but a different list depending on the context, then again, you've got reasons to sort of have external lists I haven't hard-coded anything, and my team hasn't hard-coded anything at all. I mean, in years, we'll hard-code while we're developing, but even if it's just one value, I have a policy that if it's literal, it could change. It absolutely could change. And
and it does.
And it will. Yeah. They'll tell you, this will never change. It's like, yeah, okay, fine. And then it changes, and you got to go change your code. And everybody knows that if you try to tell the project manager that you're changing code, they get all excited, and then their hair catches on fire. And so you say, I'm just going to change the configuration. And it makes them happier. And I want to make project managers happier. I really do. So what we do is we have these strings, and we first had them in INIs and CSVs. And mm-hmm. So we'd use ACL to go off and read the INIs and CSVs. Then we'd put them in a database. And I remember my least favorite presentation that I did at an Augie was explaining how we'd written the C++ DLL, and we're using a SQL Server database to maintain this stuff. And everybody's saying, well, why are you using C++? Why are you using a database? And it's like, we just came up with this model. It was what was happening at the time. Those were the things du jour, and that was what was happening. And the truth is, I'm always happy to learn a new language. And C++ wasn't my favorite, but it was fun learning it. It was good making a DLL, and the concept of having a DLL that your code connects to, I think is real valuable. Or a DLL or anything outside your code that anybody, any code can find. You know, a class, Java class, that you can do that'll make the database connection, or it'll read the XML file, and anybody can use it. ACL can use it, JavaScript can use it, you can pass it around. So what I presented on was the XML farm, and what it was the replacement to the database, right? And I had a lot of compelling business reasons for this, mainly that the whole database thing, for one thing, it was a pretty complicated set of handoffs, and stuff got messed up frequently, either because of human or inhuman reasons. And I said, hey, the time has come to lose this database approach and put this stuff in XML. Don't you think so, boss? And so we went to the business, and the business thought so. And so basically we exported all of the tables from the database and translated them into XML, put them in a folder structure, and built code to find them. And it was quite straightforward, very straightforward, to translate from get this list from a database to get this list from XML files. In fact, we just changed the name of one function, and then moved everything that was under the hood, get me this array, because we're still passing arrays. It's all arrays.
Right.
You just get the array from a database, you get it from any files, you get it from XML files, just pass me arrays. In ACL, of course, you can only have one-dimensional arrays, so that means you might be getting a lot of arrays. However you're doing it, you're reading something, and you're passing, a record set, you're passing whatever it is, For me, you might just want to be getting one thing. For example, an any call, which is basically get private profile string key, comma, or I say section, comma, key, right? And that just says square bracket, mammals, right? and then to the left of the equal sign, it says, furry, and to the right of the equal sign, it says bunny rabbit.
Right.
So just get me a furry mammal, and the answer is bunny rabbit. So that's a single an array with a zero subscript, or an ACL, a one subscript, right? Or you can get something with 1,000. You also might have to develop ways to say, for example, in our XREF lists, the various attribute values, we maintain, I don't know if it's 10,000 or 20,000 or 50,000, that's a lot, but no one group ever wants to see all those, because no one document type group, product, blah, ever has use for all 10,000. So what we do is we keep these in separate XML files. And in phase one, those are separate for each group, each product. With the approach in phase one, what I want to do is expose this stuff in phase one, and then in phase two, clean it up a bit. And wait a minute. Are all the state tax groups, for example, using one core set of XREF values, and then their only variations are these. Well, in that case, why not have one central thing that you refer to? But that's a question that has to be gone through by the business.
So, interesting.
Yeah, so there's a lot of sort of things that we do gradually. We phase stuff. I think everybody knows about that. Well, you know, I don't use the same boss that told me not to do the footnote renumber also had an expression, which was phase two. People come up with great ideas. Yeah, phase two. And now as a manager, I've learned to say the same thing, phase two. You know, and sometimes we actually get to do a phase two. But phase one for this was just service it all, get it out of the tables, into the XML. Phase two is going to be look at it and simplify it. But as I say, that's a sort of a business decision.
Interesting, interesting. Very cool. And so you are, where did the idea for doing it this way come from?
You mean as opposed,
like moving
as opposed to database approach?
Yes, and because I know that you've described it as having the different business units have shared and unshared requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Was it easier or harder to do this way, or does it matter? Maybe this is a bad question.
Beep,
I can come up with something else.
Beep. Is it? No, I think I almost know what you mean. Do you mean, it's a requirement that we have different things for different groups. So I can't, it's not my decision, you know what I'm saying? How did I come up with the approach?
Right.
It was a requirement. So I'm not really exactly sure what you mean by the approach. You mean using X, you don't mean using X.
I don't know.
Okay.
No, I'm not sure.
Okay. Beep. let's see. One thing I can say is that part of the approach for this was that we have nested groups and nested publications and nested things. So there's the federal and state tax group as a highest level. There's also Businesses Finance Guide at the highest level. Those are peers. Then inside of the federal and state tax group, there's federal tax and there's state tax. Instead of state tax, there's all the states and stuff. So I had to figure out a way to identify each group that had its own needs, because they came to us and said, look, we have needs. We have an XREF list that's different from, you know, that guy's XREF list. So you need to be able to, you know, figure out how to present us with all that we need. So what I did was I came up with this idea in the shower, trying to figure out how to actually refer to nested groups. And I thought, wait a minute, backslashes. I'll do it with backslashes. And as we all know, a backslash doesn't just mean delimiter, it means folder inside a folder. So what I did was I created an attribute value, which is content area, and we, you know, for better or worse, have, I think, about 260 content areas. They're areas of, you know, the kinds of things that would need, for example, a set of XREFs. So your content area, if you're Alaska, is FAST / ST / cluster B / AK, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I came up with this approach, which we're still using with the XML folder. We've got, a FAST folder. And inside of that, we've got an ST folder, and inside of that, we've got a cluster B folder. There are other ways to represent this. There are lots of ways to represent this. But delimiting it and using folders has been good for us, because then you can just pass a string and then grab that string and put it, I call it the middle string, I call it the middle path. Before that, you have something like, I don't know, config_root. You know, $ config underscore root, you know, that's the start of your UNC. And then you've got dot, and then you've got middle path, and then you've got dot subpath.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a basic customization approach, is to have the first part of the UNC path, and then perhaps the last part of the UNC path that you get from some kind of logic. And then the middle part that you get from a configuration file external to the code.
So are you refining as you go down, or are you overriding, or are you addressing directly?
Yes.
Okay.
All three. Sometimes backed up on top, right?
Right.
We get the basic list from above, and then we replace or stack as we go. Sometimes we replace. We have quite a few tools that work on this supposition, and the beauty of it is that it's flexible. You can certainly, depending on the kind of thing, they're all config files. There's no code inside of any of these directories. It's all configuration. Code is then made available to you, depending on your configuration.
Very common structure pattern. It's interesting.
It's also
that's
pretty.
Working
it's intuitive. It's easy to understand.
Yeah,
I can show it to somebody
is.
And they get it pretty quickly just because, oh, yeah, well, this is inside of that.
Very
that kind
cool.
of stuff.
Excellent. So what are you working on now?
Well, so what I'm working on now is, in a way, it's a refinement of that. So the current big project for us is we're bringing in a new office that has a bunch of new needs, and we're trying to create a really perfect, beautiful, archetypal, glorious Arbortext custom folder that can be used. Remember that Wolters Kluwer isn't one company, it's many companies. And what I'm trying to design goes with the current principles of design, think local, design global. And so I need to make a custom folder that will work for any Wolters Kluwer company. Any Wolters Kluwer company can then specify that, for example, even though I share this DTD, with all the other Wolters Kluwer companies, which we're trying to do, we're trying to get a DTD that works for all of our legal and, all other stuff anyway. I want to mask this element. I want to hide this element, or I want to make this element read-only. But the other company over there doesn't want to mask it. Same element, same DTD. How do we do that? We add a layer of localization. So,
interesting.
Again, my life, my experience as an Arbortext customizer has always had to take into account this complexity factor. I'm serving not serving one master, I'm serving 280. So I have to be able to handle what they want. And now I've got another group that needs to use the same code and the same DTD, but needs different logic or different rules. Different configurations. Another thing is that we're building is a suite of tools, basically an approach, but a suite of tools that are where you automatically replace a particular kind of attribute value with a particular kind of control. We already, been speaking of a list box for a text box. Well, we've already got a calendar control for, date elements. You just have an XML file that says, or date attributes, So you have an XML file that says my published element, say, I've got, I don't know what, start date, end date, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my XML file says on published start date and end date. Replace with MS-CAL, right? Or anything.
Nice.
Anything. Mm-hmm. Anything that you can replace anything with, we're just going to make that configuration. We've got the code. It's central. Anybody can use it or not use it. And then we've got configuration. And the approach, of course, of that is look for the configuration file. Just like it's localization, any kind of localization, right? Right? Look for it if it's there. For example, if your language is EN, if your language is English, Arbortext is going to look in the EN folder for stuff. If it doesn't find anything, you're not doing any aliasing, right? If it doesn't find any alias file, you're not doing any aliasing. But if it finds it, you are doing aliasing, and that's the general approach I think that most layered frameworks like this use is if it's there, use it. If it's not, don't. And have the option of replacing or adding to Delta. And so what I'm doing is I'm you know, saying you can pick and choose from what you want. I'm gonna say,
Interesting. Are they doing that on a dynamic scale, or do you set them up that way?
Say again?
So, do they get to choose this when they're working? Is it like...
No, these are business decisions.
Okay.
These are business decisions. I do have a set of things that that are for the user. You know, I remember certain non-Arbitext preferences, that right. kind of stuff. But no, generally these are going to be business decisions. I'm agnostic as to that.
Right.
If they want another layer for user, so the user can decide if they want account or control, I can give it to them. This is absolutely built with that kind of however many layers, whatever kinds of layers you want, we can include that. It's all built on the idea that you've got code and you've got configuration, and you have different kinds of configuration. You say, for example, masking, or say one group wants to have A for a given doc type, you know, DTD or schema, and another group mm-hmm. wants to have FOSSI B. Well, that's two things. That's doc type plus group, right?
Right.
So where we put that is in a subfolder of doc types, just like you know, if you want aliasing, you're going to look in the language subfolder of the given doc type folder, right? So I just created mm-hmm. another layer, which was, I call it OC for operating company. It could be anything. And then we've got doc type plus group. There are also non-doc type plus group decisions, and those I'm keeping in lib. It's all in the custom folder. I'm keeping those in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, you'd have a folder in lib, group A, group B, and in that you can keep, for example, non-markup related menu items that you want to change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's you know, a different location to keep customizations. The idea is a place for everything in its place. And the key concept for me is that a folder structure or any kind of nesting describes the thing that is contained. The folder that contains the item is an adjective, and the item is a noun.
Okay. So as in your experience as an Arbortext customizer, you probably have more experience than probably anybody I've run into.
I'm older than anybody you've run into.
nah. But so what kind of basic concepts are the most important for someone to know?
XML.
Well, yes.
I mean, that is, I think...
I mean, in terms of getting started with Arbortext customization...
I'm sorry, say
what's
again.
One of the in terms of getting started with Arbortext customization,
mm-hmm.
what's a key thing they should start with or something they should remember?
I would say look at the Arbortext code. If anything, look at the Arbortext code and see how they do things. Your eyes will glaze over, but it's a really good beginning, and it gives a good idea of the kinds of things they like to do. Second, you know, like, do that until your eyes glaze over. Second, have something you really need to build. You know, either that or just do a hello world. But I mean, what does your company need? What kinds of stuff are the users who are sitting there day in, day out, you know, pounding out their you know, in our case, tax law, you know, or whatever. You know, what are your users actually doing, and then try and build one. You know, have something. I just remember the first thing that I built, the very first thing that I built was an HTML viewer. It opened up the HTML table that the cursor was in a Internet Explorer window, and showed you what the HTML table looked like. I think that was the very first thing I ever did, and it was just because users had been asking me, "Hey, is there some way I can view this table?" It's like, "Huh, I wonder how you do that," you know. And then I went to an Arbortext class in Ann Arbor, and I asked the teacher, and he said, "Well, you could do it this way. You could do it this way. You could do it this way." And he helped me. It was really good to take the Arbortext training, the ACL training. I don't think you have to. I don't think it's absolutely utterly necessary, But I would recommend it if you can afford it, and if it makes sense. So those are the two things. Start, you know, understand XML, the three things. Understand XML, look at the Arbortext code, and do something that's like not just hello world, you know, something that's actually relevant to your life in Arbortext. You know, just do something that sounds like fun. Something, you know, some bite-sized thing, some, not something too huge. That's what I'd recommend.
Okay. So how about... What kind of thing have you, what bites you, right? What's going to bite somebody who's new? If they don't, maybe they don't understand completely how the custom folders work or.
Yeah, that.
Something
of,
underneath
sure.
that they don't know.
That kind of stuff doesn't bite us because we've been at it for so long. I guess getting familiar with the custom folders would be a pretty big kind of gotcha. For us, you know, the things that cause us pain are when Arbortext doesn't get along with something else. That's
such as
Documentum. Yeah, there seems to be a little disagreement between Arbortext and Documentum about namespaces, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay. I'm not saying one more word, but it's change tracking. Arbortext says you just can't use chain tracking with Documentum. It just doesn't work. You know, and Documentum says, yeah, well, that's because Arbortext does something that's doing something wrong. You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I really don't. I wish they'd talk to each other. But it causes us huge pain because we told the business, you can't use chain tracking. You know, and if you say that to a publishing company, they're going to say, oh, yeah, but we're going to use chain tracking. You know.
Right.
And so, and believe me, you know, the answers are, you know, we've been way down this path, and I realize that people are thinking, well, you can just do this, or you just do this. Pretty unlikely we haven't thought of that, although if you have something, I'd be interested to know how to handle that. What we do is we comment them out. We comment them out. We put chain tracking inside of comments so that when you check it in, you're checking it in, commented, and it just hurts me to do that. You know, we just found that if the buffer has more than 4,095 characters, it breaks. So there's just pain involved. There's often pain involved with having, with should we say, different interpretations of XML standards. Also, line breaks. Line breaks will cause you pain. Conversion will cause you pain.
Yes.
Artifacts of conversion will cause you pain. You know, connections will cause you pain. Firewall issues will cause you pain. Believe me, I have a rich source of pain in my working life. Fortunately, I have a brick wall right next to my desk, so I can go and bang my head against it, and that helps, I think.
Wow. These are all good things to put on the list of things for people to watch for.
I would say it's the things that we watch for, you know, that as far as the highest level of scariness that we see. You know, the things we don't have to worry about are, you know, the things that we do best, manipulate XML. When it comes down to manipulating XML, you know, that's the easy part, not the easy part. That's the fun part. That's the, you know, that works. That doesn't bite chain. That is the beauty of, you know, of Arbortext and ACL and the AOM and all this stuff, is that for the actual, you know, solid XML work, you know, if you're like if XML is your lifeblood, you know, or at least your company's lifeblood, and you spend your day in XML manipulating attributes and elements and all this kind of stuff, Arbortext is the tool for it. It is the tool for the job, and all the, you know, all the various ways of addressing the XML are really the beauty of it. That's the part I would focus on in learning Arbortext, is all the stuff that's actually around the markup. There's a ton of stuff. I mean, we built a tool because we had some colorblind people. So we built a tool so that the user could actually change the color of everything with a nice interface into, you know, background color, tag color, all that kind of stuff, right? Well, that's not markup. That's not a markup.
No.
You know, and it's good. It's great to do that kind of stuff. You really want to have a real ability to make the interface jump through hoops. That's a great thing to have. But really, the real reason that you're in there, the real reason that they're hiring you, is that the Arbortext customizer sort of stands as the guard into the repository. You don't get past Arbortext without being validated, and you don't get past me without being business validated. So the key thing is, be aware of certainly the actual software itself, but the real key thing is be aware of the markup. Understand the markup. Right? It's easy to just say, it's an element, it's an attribute, but just kind of get the architecture of it. And, I really like hanging out with the users. I think users are just great. I think they're a great bunch of people. And they know what they're doing, and they tend to make the money for the companies, and at least they do for our company, and I have a lot of respect for them. And I want to make their life faster and better. Make their work faster and better. I want to make their life better.
Thanks.
I want to make them happy. I like it when they don't yell at me.
Exactly. That's always good. Wow. So, let's see. So, you've had a lot of people come on over the years. And we all know that it's hard to find anyone who does Arbortext that's out there in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of growing pains do you see when you have a new person come on in your group?
I have been unbelievably lucky to have nothing but rock stars working for me. They're all incredible. I have three people working for me, and all of them were really good coders. And understood publishing when they came on. And so we didn't have so many growing pains. It was a real, I don't know what to say about that, Liz. I'm just incredibly lucky as a manager to have had hardly any growing pains. Yeah, they had to learn it. But, they already understood the concept of certainly of XML. And so just adding the ability to manipulate it with Arbortext was just a fun new thing for them to do. I wish I could.
So do you think it was key that they had publishing experience? They know your business model more than an XML than anything else?
Yes, I think that's absolutely the key thing is that, you need, when you're getting into it, you need to have a sense of what those words are doing on the page and where they're going to go, and that sort of idea of publishing, at least in the publishing company, it's the key thing. That's for two of the people who work for me. The other one I hired right out of college, and she didn't know much about Arbortext, but she knew she was quite good at programming. And now she's absolutely an ace. I mean, she's really good at Arbortext. And we've matured as a team. We've gotten better. But mainly the growing pains for us have been when we have to interface with some new thing. We used to use Textel Information Manager and Ivory's and Documentum. Used to use any files, and we used databases, then we used XML files. All those were, they weren't growing pains, but they were like dealing with, a basic concept that we have is I hand you something and you hand me something back. I, for example, I make a query, the user says, I want all the links that look like this, all the links that have to do with cheese, and I want them to be in Wisconsin. Okay, so cheese, Wisconsin, click search. Well, we send out cheese in Wisconsin as a query, and then get back all of the decisions of the Wisconsin Cheese Board, regarding Swiss cheese, cheddar cheese, over the last 20 years, because the database handled us that back. Well, those kinds of things, those connections to other things, are often. Well, they're not. They can be growing pains because you have to learn about them. You have to know how SQL works and stuff. But that ain't so bad. They pay us to.
How many kinds of places do you pull information from?
We pull information indirectly from Documentum. We still pull information from a CSV for one tool. We are interfacing with a SQL Server database for another tool, and but mostly it's the XML files. It's mostly the XML farm. That's almost all of our getting and stuff like that. And that was on purpose. We really wanted to move in that direction to kind of simplify where we get all this stuff from. But the key thing now that we're just getting into, and I really, in all the years that I've been working with Arbortext and Documentum, we've never had a use for the WK adapter. So that's my new thing. And I'll talk to you some other time or in the next year about what it was like to learn the WK adapter.
What is the WK adapter?
They
build you something special?
Kit? What?
Did they build you something special?
No. This is Arbortext adapter to Documentum. They have an adapter to Oracle, an adapter to IBM, you know, obviously Windchill. We use Documentum.
Right.
I'm not terribly fond of Documentum. I'd rather be using something different, to be honest with you. And it's really no secret that I feel that way. But, Arbortext, knows they have customers with all those different kinds of repositories, and so they make adapters, which I think, basically it's, you can check in from the menu, you can paste by reference and get object IDs and stuff from directly from the repository.
I've always heard it called the Documentum adapter.
Yeah.
So when you said WK adapter, I'm like, oh, they built you a special WK.
Yeah, I know. Around here, it's WDK, Webhot Development Kit. It's how Documentum lets you build web apps that get presented in Tomcat or whatever. And they didn't build us anything. and the truth is, I don't want them to. I want to build it myself. Ha ha. But at least we'll use this adapter, which is basically like so many things. It's based ultimately on a DLL, and I think an OCX or something that actually does the talking to Documentum, that opens the connection, all that kind of stuff. So we're going to be using that.
Cool. Well, so as the senior guy on the most senior guy that probably I will be interviewing lately, anyway. Unless, of course, I talk to somebody inside Arbortext. What advice do you have for new people who are thinking about doing this or getting started or just got it, don't know what to do, don't know how to get started?
Right. As I said before, my best, biggest advice after, sort of getting at least familiar with the software that you're going to be using, assuming that's the Arbortext editor, have a look at it. Look at it from your own needs, the point of view of your own needs, and if your own needs include any kind of, complex XML and, any kind of, or if your documents are very long, you're going to want to go with a heavyweight XML editor. So you've got XML, you've got Arbortext, there are choices that you can make. I'm actually kind of fond of XML. I think it's kind of cool in certain ways, but I really believe that Arbortext is far, far better, and could be happy to explain, the various reasons why. It's, everybody's got an opinion.
Go for it. Go for it. We got plenty of time.
No.
Unless you don't want to.
Some other
it's
time.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Then I would have to, 'cause I know what they are. I know what they are. I can find them, but I don't want to expound on them right now because it's not on the tip of my tongue. But, look at what you need. Look at what are you going to be doing with Arbortext. It's one of the most, customizable pieces of software out there. The level of customization that you can do with Arbortext is phenomenal, as it has to be. That's what I tell people. You can't, this isn't Microsoft where you don't just buy it and sit it on people's desks. Well, you can. You can. Right. If you really want to be using AX DocBook or, you know, the service manual app or did a, you know, those are pretty evolved and robust applications. Right. You may be able to get by with just that out of the box.
So if you started in 97-ish time, it's been 12 years.
Yeah.
So you've seen a lot of upgrades in the basic editor over that time, as well as maintenance releases.
Right.
How hard, easy has it been for you to upgrade your customizations?
The two difficult upgrades for us were going from 4.2 to, I think, 4.1, which meant that we had to change everything for the custom folder, which came before the 4.3.
Okay.
And, you know, that was huge.
That was kind of an architectural shift for them, though, too, I think.
And it was a good one. I resisted it at first because I had so much built around other ways of getting things, and I saw it as, and I, in a certain way, I still see it as kind of limiting in certain ways. I guess as a programmer, you want to be able to do anything any way you want, and then they give you a framework, and you have to do it their way. Turns out their way of doing it is actually pretty damn good and seems to encompass everything. But that did involve a fairly large change, and by the way, we had a contractor do a lot of that work.
Right.
We could have done it ourselves, but we had a contract.
Yeah.
So that was a fairly big change, and I think 5.4 is going to be a pretty big change. We hope to use a lot of the new goodies that are basically for sort of distributed enterprise implementation.
Right. All right. Oh, yeah, the distribution kit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, that looks like big fun,
It does.
I think we are going to have, I will be able to convince the business that it was their idea that we need to start using this stuff.
Cool. Well, so then in 12 years, having really one, maybe two, we don't even know yet, major shifts for customization, that's a pretty good record.
Is what?
You haven't had much trouble upgrading then?
The other big change that we had, last year we went from 5.1N1 to 5.3M20, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we found, we're running this on Citrix boxes, and we found that we couldn't do the 5.1N1 install on a 64-bit box.
Oh.
And that happened. We discovered that, or just say, you know, Ops discovered that while we were at Augie last year, year before last.
Oh, yeah.
So we spent a certain amount of time just right there, you know, on a VPN from the hotel room, you know, trying to figure out various ways to deal with this. And the way to deal with it, of course, was to use 5.3. And 5.3, unfortunately, did have a lot of you know, subtle and not so subtle differences. So that's really the only one that I can remember in all those years was a nightmare or even painful, particularly aside from moving to.
So is that due in part to the way you designed and implemented the customizations?
I'd like to think so, Liz. I'd like to think so. I think that it's very important to build an extremely flexible and open architecture. And the fact that I built it that way has many times saved my framework. And
so describe what you mean by that for other people who are maybe not as familiar with it as you.
If you've got a nested folder way of getting a configuration, for example, you may not need everything at every level. But you might want to have more than one level so that you can keep stuff at each level. In other words, I've been saved by the fact that they said, oh, yeah, this will always only contain that. This will always, there'll never be anything else. And then something comes along and they need a peer to that. Well, I've rather than just, you know, saying, okay, they're associated directly, I've got, and I'm speaking very abstractly now. It can be folder structures, it can mm-hmm. be programming structures. I've got a place for both, you know, the new one and the old one, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have to find a new place. The place is already there. And that's one sort of level of flexible coding and configuration that I can highly recommend. Just save my butt many times.
Nice. That's a good suggestion.
Yeah. A place for everything and everything in its place. And then you might even want to have, you know, it look to the future and say, are they ever going to spring something on you? And if you think that might happen, make a place for it. Make a holding place for it.
There you go. Very cool. All right. Well, so I think we've gone a while. I think it's good.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you, Todd, for taking time this morning to describe what you're doing at Wolters Kluwer and give us some peek into the little things that you've done. I know that there's many, many more.
Yes. And I think that my next presentation at the PTC User Conference will be fun.
I'm looking forward to it.
Indeed.
And you're going to do a live meeting, show off what you're doing?
Always.
Excellent. Always love to have that. Great.
The PubRide Podcast is a production of Single Sourcing Solutions in San Jose, California. Copyright 2009. Single Sourcing Solutions.